Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us. This is a personal finance show on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein. Today is episode 477. It's part one of our National Debt Masterclass. In the next three episodes of Money for the Rest of Us, in conjunction with our 10th anniversary, we wanted to have an in-depth discussion of one of the greatest potential long-term risks for investors, the U.S. national debt. It's a topic we have covered over 15 times on the podcast. And the reality is, my view and concern regarding the national debt has changed in the past decade. In the past 10 years, I estimate I've written and spoken at least 3 million words in conjunction with the Money for the Rest of Us free podcast, plus episodes, investment guides on the website, the Insider's Guide email newsletter, and in one book. That's equivalent to writing 50 books, 5 books a year. With all that speaking and writing has allowed me to look at a specific topic, such as the national debt, from many different angles, to go back to it again and again, trying to really understand the topic and get better at explaining it as I come to understand it. For this national debt series, I re-listened to a number of the episodes we released on the topic to see what I said and whether it still applied. Those earlier episodes are helpful in setting the stage for this national debt series. I want to share with you in part one, portions of episode 1 and 4 from Money for the Rest of Us, released in May 2014, as well as a portion of episode 157, released in May 2017. The audio has been remastered, although admittedly, in 2017, my delivery was a little too intense. How I speak on the podcast is one of the things that has changed in the past 10 years. Part one, then, of this series, our National Debt Masterclass, focuses on the idea that a country that issues debt in its own currency can't default on that debt unless it chooses to. A country can always create the money to make interest in principal payments. By doing so, it replaces interest-bearing debt with non-interest-bearing currency, fiat currency. Likewise, a country working through its central bank can control the interest rate it pays on its debt. And we'll see in the case of Japan in this episode how that's done. And finally, the ability to create unlimited amounts of money through government spending, quantitative easing, and issuing bank loans means federal government borrowing can't crowd out the private sector, sucking up all the savings so the private sector can't get access to capital. It just doesn't work that way. There is an unlimited amount of money. What there isn't an unlimited amount of are real resources, land, people, projects, ideas. When the supply of money overtakes the private sector's ability to produce goods and services, that leads to inflation or potentially hyperinflation. When a government actively destroys the private sector economy, as we'll see in this episode with Venezuela. At the conclusion of this episode, I'll give you a preview of what we'll cover in part two of our National Debt Masterclass.
So when we talk about money, we're not talking about theory anymore. It's now just digits. So mechanically, what happens? They just can change the digits because it isn't anything. Money is nothing. Why then do we invest? The main reason we invest, because we want to take this nothingness, which is money, which are just numbers, which are just digits, and we want to buy real resources. We want to take this nothingness and buy something of value that creates income that will hopefully outpace inflation.
How could the federal government go bankrupt? What would it take? Well, how does a business go bankrupt? Businesses go bankrupt when they have so many expenses they don't have any income. They don't have any money. They run out of money. The federal government run out of money? It can't, because the federal government has a monopoly over the currency. They can create money out of thin air simply by spending. It's impossible for the federal government to go bankrupt unless politicians choose to. But mechanically, it just can't be done because there's always money to pay off the debt. And investors, if they're wise, they know that. They know that federal government debt, which is really treasury bonds and notes and bills, is risk-free. The government can't go bankrupt. One of the things that just it dumbfounds me, there's always this phrase, our children and our grandchildren are going to be having to pay off this national debt. We're leaving them with this huge burden. That perspective is only looking at one side of the seesaw. In your life, when was the last time anyone came and knocked on your door and wanted to collect the debt that your grandparents and great-grandparents incurred, the federal government? In other words, federal government debt from decades ago. Nobody comes and collects federal government debt because the debt is somebody else's asset. And there's a huge demand to hold federal government debt because it's risk-free. The government can't go bankrupt. And so the national debt will never be paid off, ever. It hasn't been paid off since the 1850s. If the federal government tried to pay off the debt, the only way they could do that is to run a surplus. And what happens when the government runs a surplus? That means the private sector on the other side of the seesaw has to run a deficit, which means the private sector is spending more than they're taking in the income, which they can't do over an extended period of time. The federal government can't pay off its debt. It just won't ever be able to, because as soon as it runs a surplus for a year or so, the economy goes into a recession. The economy contracts. What happens when the economy contracts? Income goes down, which means as incomes go down, household and businesses are paying less income taxes. And so federal government revenue goes down because the tax dollars are less. You don't even have to change the tax rate. The tax dollars are less, so tax income drops. At the same time, unemployment goes up, and so the federal government is paying more unemployment benefits. And so the government's expenditures are going up while their income is dropping, which means they actually switch over from a surplus to a deficit. That's just the way the math works.
Before we continue, let me pause and share some words from one of this week's sponsors, Shopify. Lapril and I recently had dinner with some friends who run a retail business. They have multiple stores and an online shop, and they recently used Shopify to better manage their inventory so they could ship online orders out of all of their stores instead of the warehouse. It helped them get a higher conversion rate on their website because of Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers, just like it did for our friends. With the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/David, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/David now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/David. Okay, those are portions of episode 1 and 4 released in 2014. Let me share part of episode 157 released in May 2017. We start off with a report by the Congressional Budget Office that was released in 2017 on the national debt situation at that time and some of their warnings that they gave in that report.
The report includes the dire warning that, quote, the prospect of such large and growing debt poses substantial risk for the nation, end quote. Specifically, the CBO believes that if the national debt rose to the level it is projecting, it would, quote, hurt the economy and increase the likelihood of a fiscal crisis in which investors become unwilling to finance a government's borrowing unless they are compensated with very high interest rates, end quote. The CBO states that the resulting jump in interest rates, quote, would reduce the market value of outstanding government securities, and investors could lose money. The resulting losses from mutual funds, pension funds, insurance companies, banks, and other holders of government debt might be large enough to cause some financial institutions to fail, creating a fiscal crisis, end quote.
That's scary. Now, the Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan entity that produces, according to the website, independent analysis of budgetary and economic issues to support the congressional budget process. The fact that the CBO is nonpartisan does not mean the organization does not have a point of view. It does. It has a theoretical bias about how the global economy and financial system operates. We need to understand what that bias is in order to analyze their conclusions. The CBO believes large budget deficits require the federal government to borrow more money from the private sector to finance the deficit. It writes, if the government borrowed more, more people's savings would be used to buy treasury securities, and thus private investment would be crowded out. Crowded out. That's a key term. In other words, there would be, according to the CBO, less private savings, including bank deposits, which businesses could borrow in order to invest in productivity-enhancing projects, because so much money would be sitting in government bonds. The CBO writes, with less investment in capital goods, factories and computers, for example, workers would be less productive. Because productivity growth is the main driver of growth in people's compensation, decreased investment also would reduce average compensation per hour, offering people less incentive to work. The CBO's view, and that of many economists, is that a limiting constraint on the economy is the amount of money. A higher federal debt level means the government sucks up an increasing percentage of the limited money supply, leaving less for the private sector to save and invest. In order to entice investors to finance these ever larger budget deficits, interest rates will have to increase. This in turn will result in less investment by private businesses in productive projects that can increase economic growth. That's because the return on investment for individual projects will have to be greater than it would otherwise in order to pay higher interest costs on the debt used to fund the project. Higher hurdle rates would mean fewer viable investment projects, which means lower productivity for the entire economy and lower wages for workers. If the economy doesn't become more productive, if businesses are not able to produce more goods and services per hour of labor, then workers won't get wages. If there is a limited supply of money, then the federal government could indeed crowd out private sector investment, as annual budget deficits reduce private sector savings. This is the most important question of our time, the most important economic question. Is the supply of money limited or is it unlimited? Because if it's limited, then we can have crowding out of the private sector. Interest rates could skyrocket, bond prices would plunge, and that we could have a fiscal crisis. So that's a theory. And I've done episodes on the national debt, and you kind of know where I stand. I do not believe that there is a limited supply of money. Some would call me, well, Michael Tanner, for example, of the Cato Institute, not that I've met him, but I just read his book or started reading his book. He would call me a debt denier because I do not believe in the terrible ramifications of the national debt. But I choose to read his book because I want to see what the argument is, because I have the observation and I have the theory, but I could be wrong. And so I want to read and learn what the other side is saying. What is the basis for their argument? So he has a book. Michael Tanner, he's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. His book is called Going for Broke. He writes, government borrowing tends to crowd out private investment because a dollar borrowed by the government is a dollar no longer available for private use. If the government takes it, then a business, the private sector, cannot borrow that dollar, and there's crowding out and there's this competition. And if there's a competition to borrow money, rates potentially could go up because there wouldn't be enough savings for the private sector to borrow. Tanner compares the federal government to a family sitting around the kitchen table discussing their household budget and realizing they spend more than they bring in, and that if they've been borrowing, as he says, the rest and living off credit cards for years, that same family has not put anything away for unexpected expenses and has promised to pay their children's college tuition and will have responsibility for their aging parents. He writes, if the U.S. government were a family, that's pretty much the situation it would find itself in. Except the U.S. government isn't a family. It's a sovereign entity with its own currency, printing press, and central bank that oversees a private banking system that has the ability to create an endless supply of money. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke wrote in 2002, under a fiat, that is, paper money system, a government, in practice a central bank in cooperation with other agencies, should always be able to generate increased nominal spending and inflation. The U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today, its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost. Bernanke also wrote, money is special. It's not only a zero-interest liability, but also a perpetual liability. If you pull out a dollar bill across every piece of U.S.-issued paper, the words are written on the top, Federal Reserve Note. A note, in this context, is a debt instrument issued by the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank. Does this paper note pay interest? No. Can you turn it into the Federal Reserve and redeem it for gold or for some other form of payment? No. If you brought a bag full of $100 bills to the Federal Reserve, Central Bank would either exchange it for more cash or credit your bank account for the same amount. In other words, dollars are indeed perpetual liabilities of the federal government as issued by its bank, the U.S. Federal Reserve. Here's how Columbia University economist Michael Woodford puts it. He wrote, a government that issues debt denominated in its own currency is in a different situation from that of private borrowers, in that its debt is a promise only to deliver more of its own liabilities. A treasury bond is simply a promise to pay dollars at various future dates, but these dollars are simply additional government liabilities that happen to be non-interest earning. There is thus no possible doubt about the government's technical ability to deliver what it has promised. The federal government can create an unlimited supply of money. And how does it do that? It does it by spending. Pavlina R. Chaturneva of the Levy Economics Institute wrote, when the Treasury spends, non-government entities who receive the income also receive brand new bank deposits. This is because the Federal Reserve clears the government expenditures. It credits private bank accounts with reserves. What does that mean? Well, that means that when the government spends money, it's all done electronically. They make a payment. It clears to the Federal Reserve that puts that deposit in the bank account of the entity. There is no need to wait for the money from a technical standpoint. We're going to look at what happens operationally, but from a technical standpoint, since it's all electronic digits, that's how money is created. Government spending creates new bank deposits for the private sector. Doesn't have to find the money. The money is created through this accounting entity cleared by the Federal Reserve. Bank deposits, like paper currency, are also perpetual liabilities. Although in the case of bank deposits, the bank may elect to pay some interest on them. When the government issues a treasury bond, all that is happening is non-interest-bearing notes, dollars, are converted into interest-bearing assets. Likewise, when commercial banks make loans, they also create new bank deposits, which is a liability of the bank, while offsetting it on its accounting books with a new asset called a loan receivable. And I discuss that in a great deal of detail on episode 94, how money is created and destroyed.
Before we continue, let me pause and share some words from this week's sponsors. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one program and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. With everything getting more expensive these days, it's wise to find ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. You can do that with NetSuite. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. head to netsuite.com/David. That's netsuite.com/David. netsuite.com/David.
If the money supply is unlimited, then federal spending does not crowd out the private sector. But if it is, then it does crowd out the private sector, and that could lead to ballooning interest rates. So what do? We have to actually observe what is happening. On September 21st, 2016, the Bank of Japan, Japan's central bank, made a startling announcement. They announced a new policy framework, and I'm quoting from their press release. It consists of two major components. The first is yield curve control, in which the bank will control short and long-term interest rates. And the second is inflation overshooting commitment, in which the bank commits itself to expanding the monetary base until the year-on-year rate of increase in the observed consumer price index, inflation, exceeds this price stability target of 2% and stays above that target in a stable manner. What are they saying? They're saying they're going to control interest rates and they're going to create enough money to spark higher inflation. How are they going to do that in terms of controlling interest rates? They say in the press release, the bank will purchase Japanese government bonds so that 10-year JGB yields, that's short for Japanese government bonds, will remain more or less at the current level around 0%. That's what they said 6 months ago, more than 6 months ago. And you know where the Japanese 10-year treasury is? It is right around 0%. The highest it's got was early this February at 0.1%. This is from a country with the highest public debt balance in the world, the highest gross debt to GDP in terms of their national debt, 238%. That's what it was in 2015. Here's an article. This was in a Bloomberg. Martin Schultz, he's a senior economist at Fujitsu Research Institute in Tokyo. He says, Japan is a country where public debt in private hands is falling the fastest anywhere. While Japan's estimated gross government debt is now over twice the size of the economy, as I mentioned, 240%, according to Schultz's calculation, using BOJ data, the shuffle of holdings from private actors like banks and households to the central bank is having a big impact. It means debt in private hands will fall to about 100% of GDP in 2 to 3 years, from 177% just before Prime Minister Shinzo Abe took power in late 2012. That's what he estimates. So the Bank of Japan is buying government bonds. It is monetizing the debt. At the same time, it's controlling interest rates. What's occurring is an observation is not what's supposed to happen. They're not facing this fiscal crisis where interest rates are skyrocketing despite the high debt balances. Another quote from the article, this is by Adair Turner, who's chairman of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He writes, I do not believe there is any credible scenario in which Japanese government debt can be repaid in the normal sense of the word repay. It would therefore be useful to make clear to the Japanese people that the public debt does not all have to be repaid, since some of it can be permanently monetized by the Bank of Japan. That's exactly what's happening. They are monetizing the debt and controlling interest rates. That's what we're observing. And that contradicts the theory, at least as put out by many economists, that there is a limited supply of money and that the public sector is crowding out the private sector because the central bank is creating the money to buy those bonds and they're creating the money to buy the bonds so they can control interest rates, and they have been successful. Now, we're going to have to continue to observe and see how these things play out. But as of now, the theory and the logic as we walk through how the banking system works says that the federal government can create unlimited supply of money, that the private banking sector that is overseen by the Federal Reserve can create an unlimited supply of money through their lending activities. And so there is not a crowding out. And so it is not a given that interest rates will spike and that the federal debt will get out of control. Because here we have the largest country in the world, Japan, or the largest debt balance in the world, and they'll be able to pull down that public debt balance as a percent of GDP as they monetize debt. And they've not seen inflation. And Japan's economy, while it does obviously have its issues, has been doing relatively well on a per capita basis. They struggle because the demographics are not in their favor. The population is shrinking, and that makes it hard to grow the overall economy because they don't have more workers. But at the same time, they are becoming more productive, and GDP per capita since 1991, so over the past 25 years, so the amount of economic output per person has grown at 0.7%. That's real per capita GDP, 0.7%. It's gone from $40,000 in 1991 to $47,641 at the end of 2016. That's using 2005 dollars, and obviously they converted the yen to the dollar. You compare that to the U.S., gone from $37,500 in 1991 to $52,195 per person at the end of 2016. So about a 1.3% growth rate. So a little higher for the U.S., but Japan, you know, they're hanging in there. In 2015, I read the book Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. It's apocalyptic. It was disturbing. It had governments collapsing, roving gangs, corruption, jackdaws, which is a terrifying name, not enough food. And I was reminded of that the other day when I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about Venezuela and their people are starving. The article profiled Jean-Pierre Planchard, who's a year old. He's got a drawn face, and I'm reading from the article now, of an old man and a cry that is a little more than a whimper. His ribs show through his skin. He weighs just 11 pounds. His mother, Maria Planchard, tried to feed him what she could, combing through the trash, scraps of chicken or potatoes. She finally took him to the hospital in Caracas, where she prays a rice milk concoction keeps her son alive. I watched him sleep and sleep, getting weaker all the time, losing weight, she said. I never thought I'd see Venezuela like this. Her country was once Latin America's richest producing food for export. Venezuela now can't grow enough food to feed its own people in an economy hobbled by the nationalization of private farms and price and currency controls. Venezuela has the world's highest inflation, 720% last year. It's rising at least 20% a month in this year. Since 2013, the economy has shrunk 27%, according to local investment bank Torino Capital. The article goes on. It says, hordes of people, many with children in tow, rummaged through garbage, an uncommon sight a year ago. People in the countryside pick farms clean at night, stealing everything from fruits hanging on trees to pumpkins on the ground, adding to the misery of farmers hurt by shortages of seed and fertilizer. Looters target food stores, family padlock their refrigerators. What in the world is going on in Venezuela? The Venezuela government can create money, but they have a problem. The wealth of a nation is their ability to produce goods and services. Venezuela's ability to do that has been completely undermined by corruption, by the state taking over many private businesses, by putting in private price controls. They have essentially destroyed their own economy by trying to manage it from the top down. They've taken over 1,400 private businesses the government has expropriated since 1998. Recently, GM plant, the car plant, was shut down, taken over by the Venezuelan authorities, and GM laid off 2,700 workers. The Wall Street Journal article profiled a hog farmer, Alberto Troiani. He's 48. He works at the hog farm that his father, an Italian immigrant, founded in the 1970s. His business has now been battered by price controls, a shortage of supply, and criminal gangs. The farm has gone from 200 female pigs, each producing a dozen piglets, to 50. Mr. Troiani can't afford the high protein feed and medicines he once used. Full-grown pigs now weigh 175 pounds instead of 240. We used to send 120 to 150 pigs a month to slaughter, Mr. Troiani said. Now it's 50, 60 animals, a joke. He makes 93 cents per kilogram or 2.2 pounds of meat, he said, but needs $1.17 to make a profit. Since 2012, 82% of Venezuela pig producers have closed and production has fallen 71%, according to industry representatives. The agricultural companies the government has taken over, including milk factories and distributors of fertilizer and feed, are closed or barely operating, according to economists and farm groups. That's the Wall Street Journal. That's scary. That is what's happening in Venezuela. And now they're having massive protests, and we'll see what happens. A big problem with Venezuela is they have the largest oil reserves in the world, but it's been mismanaged. Their economy has been mismanaged for decades. There's a policy paper put out by the Cato Institute. I'll link to this in the show notes. This policy paper talked about Venezuela. It says, Venezuela went from being one of the most well-off countries in Latin America and worldwide in the 1950s to a period of stagnation and even decline. Over two decades, its real income per capita declined by 25%. In 1988, 2.4% of Venezuelans were living below the poverty line. But by 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected president, that figure had risen to 18.5%, which is one reason he was elected and was able to implement a form of socialism and or communism. The article goes on. Few people realize that Venezuela's current oil reserves are the largest in the world. They are about a dozen times larger than what Venezuela had at its disposal in the 1980s. Venezuela has been hurt by falling oil prices. At the same time, a large percentage of their national debt is foreign debt. It's denominated in U.S. dollars, which doesn't give them the flexibility that the U.S. has or Japan has, where their debt is denominated in their own currency, so it can be monetized, and so they can control interest rates. Venezuela doesn't have that flexibility, and they've mismanaged their economy, and they've tried to control it from the top down, and the wealth has been dissipated because their wealth is their ability to produce goods and services, and now, literally, their people are starving, and it is very, very sad. So back to the most important economic question of our time. Can the federal government that issues its own currency and has its debt denominated in its own currency, can it create an unlimited supply of money? Can it control interest rates? Can it not crowd out the private sector? Absolutely. And we're seeing it happen. We're seeing it happen in Japan. But does that mean the federal government can do anything it wants, create an unlimited supply of money? No. The constraint is the ability of the private sector to produce goods and services. And if too much money is created, that will lead to inflation and can lead to market interest rates, even though maybe the government bond rates controlled, market interest rates for borrowing debt will be much, much higher. And so the constraint is the government's ability to make sure inflation is kept in check, that not too much money is created, and not undermine the private sector's ability to become more productive and to continue to use their ingenuity and hire more workers. We should be more focused on big, important issues of how to increase productivity by focusing on our educational system. How can we have more educated students? How can we get more people out of poverty so they have more opportunities so they can be productive workers? Why is it the healthcare cost, as pointed out by Warren Buffett, in the U.S. as a percent of GDP is 17.1%, significantly higher than other developed countries such as Germany at 11.3%, Japan at 10.2%, Britain at 9.1%. That's a competitive disadvantage the U.S. has relative to other countries in terms of their productivity, their ability to compete. Those are issues we should be focusing on, not some issue that's many years down the road regarding the national debt. We're not having a financial crisis, a fiscal crisis in the U.S., nor in Japan. And if we look at how the financial system actually works, and not how it worked 50 years ago when we were on the gold standard, where there was the inability of the government to create unlimited amounts of money, and they could crowd out the private sector because every dollar could be exchanged for gold. Now money is digital. It's electronic. The federal government has a printing press, an electronic printing press. Private banks create money by lending. So the constraint is not their ability to create money and service debt. The constraint is making sure we have responsible government that they're not creating too much money and leading to inflation.
So those are a portion of several episodes from 2014 and 2017 of Money for the Rest of Us. We covered four principles. One, the national debt won't be paid off. Two, government can control the terms of its debt issuance, including interest rates. Three, government debt doesn't crowd out the private sector's ability to borrow and invest. And the fourth principle is there is no free lunch. Too much money creation leads to inflation. In our next episode, part two of this series, we focus on, while these four things are true, the private sector, including commercial banks, can choose not to play the game, to not hold the government debt or the currency. We have a choice. Private sector has a choice. We look at the ramifications of that choice not to want to hold the fiat currency or the national debt issued in that fiat currency in our next episode, episode 478. Did you know you may be missing some of the best Money for the Rest of Us content? Our weekly Insider's Guide email newsletter goes beyond what we cover on podcast episodes and helps elevate your investment journey with information that works best in written or visual formats. With the Insider's Guide, you can discover actionable investing insights provided only to our newsletter subscribers. Unlock greater investing confidence with high-value snippets from our premium products, plus membership and asset camp. Access exclusive news, offers, and events you won't hear about anywhere else. And connect with the Money for the Rest of Us team and community. And when you sign up, we'll send you our exclusive investing checklist to help you invest with more confidence right away. The Insider's Guide is the best next step to get the most out of your investment journey. If you're not on the list, subscribe at moneyfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening to part one. Everything we've shared with you in this episode has been for general education. I've not considered your specific risk situation. I've not provided investment advice. This is simply general education on money, investing in the economy. Have a great week.